This presentation is sponsored by Lumina Foundation as part of WFYI's American Graduate Let's Make It Happen initiative, made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Lumina Foundation's goal is to increase the percentage of Americans with high-quality degrees and credentials to 60% by the year 2025. Goal 2025 is focused especially on adults, first-generation college students, low-income students, and students of color.
Welcome, everyone. This is a part of our Education Reform Now Educate Indiana informational series. This is our third event, I believe, of four. We have another one planned for June, which I'll talk a little bit about later. And I appreciate all of our panelists being here and our special guest, Senator Johnston from Colorado. I will introduce all of them formally here in a second. I did want to indicate that we do have question cards for the audience. So if you have questions, we have some tremendous assistants that will be bringing those around. If you just raise your hand, I guess would be the best way to do this. If you don't have a card or if you have a card to turn in, they will collect those from you. And we'll try to get as many of those questions answered, asked and answered as we possibly can. The format that we're going to do tonight is I will introduce Senator Johnston here in a second. We will have him speak for a while, and then we will go to a panel, which will be moderated by Mr. Matt Tully. The focus of tonight's event is on the importance of accountability. Accountability is a word that gets thrown around quite a bit, and I think it's probably another one of those words in the education world that starts to take on a lot of different meanings to a lot of different folks. So we're hoping to explore that a little bit more deeply tonight and especially get into something that's really starting to happen here in Indiana, and that is teacher evaluations, which truly is another aspect of accountability and part of really what I believe is the foundation of education reform. But I will turn that over to others much more well-versed than I to speak about. I would like to thank WFYI for being here again this evening and recording this, and I believe live streaming it is the reason that we were counting down tonight. So be on your best behavior because you might be live streamed to somebody's home in Hong Kong or anywhere else as far as that's concerned. I also want to thank our friends here at the library. I see Melanie and Chris, I believe, was here. Thank you again for all your hospitality. They do a tremendous job here of preparing everything for us and everyone else that's been part of the broader informational series. I also want to thank my friends and colleagues from Education Reform Now. Miles Mendoza and Molly Thielson are sitting up there, and they're trying to blend into the scenery, but they are a huge part of why we're able to do this evening and all of our informational series. So thank you so much. And Molly's doing a double role. She's also handing out and collecting questions from everyone this evening. I also want to thank my right-hand person, which is actually the real leader of our organization, and that's Kelly Bentley. Kelly is all over all of the details we need for planning these events. I just kind of come in and make a lot of mistakes, as she can tell you. So a big thank you to Kelly. And Aisha, is she here? Aisha's up there. This is my new right-hand person who has been will be helping us this summer. Thank you so much. You did a splendid job on your first go-around here. This information series is really to introduce everybody to education reform issues. And like I said, tonight we're going to focus on accountability. We are tremendously pleased to have with us one of the foremost experts on accountability policy in the nation, and somebody that I think you're going to just think a great deal of after speaking here this evening. Senator Mike Johnston represents the northeast part of Denver, Colorado, and serves as a policy advisor to new leaders for new schools. Mike first entered education as a high school English teacher in Greenville, Mississippi, an experience that led him to write his acclaimed book, In the Deep Heart's Core. After leaving Mississippi Delta, Mike co-founded New Leaders for New Schools, a national nonprofit that recruits and trains urban principals. Mike started his own career as a principal leading two alternative high schools serving Colorado students held in state custody and living in group homes and detention centers. Most recently, Mike was the co-founder and principal of MESA, which is the Mapleton Expeditionary School of the Arts. Easy for me to say. A redesigned urban high school in the Mapleton Public Schools that made Colorado history by becoming the first public high school in which 100% of seniors were admitted to four-year colleges. Well done. He has been an adjunct professor of education law at the University of Denver and has served as an advisor to state and federal political campaigns around the country, most recently as top education advisor to Barack Obama's presidential campaign and transition. Recently named to Time Magazine's 40 Under 40 and Forbes Magazine list of the seven most powerful educators, Mike holds degrees from Yale College and the Harvard Graduate School of Education and the Yale Law School. Just had to get one more, huh? He sits on the board of many local and national organizations, including the I Have a Dream Foundation and the Urban League. He lives in Northeast Denver with his wife, Courtney, who is the deputy district attorney in Denver. Their two sons, twin sons, I believe you said, Emmett and Seamus, and their new baby girl, Ava. Congratulations. And with that, I am proud to introduce Senator Mike Johnson.
Thank you all so much for being here, and thank you for having me. I really just came on behalf of the city of Denver to thank you for sending us your greatest natural resource, Peyton Manning. So I was actually delighted. I landed in the airport, and the first thing I saw was Broncos Peyton Manning jerseys on sale in the airport. So I thought it was fantastic. All seriousness aside, we'll get back to education. I just want to tell a couple of stories about how what the work we've done in Colorado, what I think we've learned along the way, and hopefully what lessons maybe there are in it from our own mistakes that may help some of your efforts here. I want to start by saying that there are a couple of folks in the room already who are courageously carrying the mantle here in this city and in this state who are my own education advocate heroes. And so I want to say a big thank you to the City Council President Maggie Lewis, who's up here in the back, and to Representative Marianne Sullivan, who's here in the front. Thank you all so much for all the work that you're doing for kids here in the state and around the city. So thank you both. So as was mentioned, I came at this as a high school principal. So I was a high school principal before I ran for the state senate, and I had the opportunity to spend 4 years as the principal of an urban high school that was one of the lowest performing schools in the state. And we had a courageous superintendent who said, we need to close this high school and open a couple of new small high schools in its place, and so hired some new principals to do that. And I had the privilege of opening one of those high schools. And same neighborhood, same population of kids, but I got the chance to hire our staff from scratch, build a model together, and we ran an art school. So you can, none of the rest of the acronym is discernible, but the word arts at the end from MESA represents the idea that we had to focus on arts. So our belief was explicitly that we didn't want to narrow the curriculum. We didn't want to have kids only take language arts and math because those were tested subjects. We have every student at our school takes art every trimester of every year. So art is a core course, just like math or science or language or arts or social studies. I would always say that the only miracle about MESA was the people that work in the building. And so we had a team of 28 teachers, and many of them were veteran teachers who'd been in the district for a long time. Some of them were new to the profession. Some of them came from around the state, around the country. But when we opened, we started with a simple vision, which is we believe that every one of the kids in this building has the chance to go to college. And so on the very first day, we put all 100 of our 10th graders in a circle. And our population's about 70% Latino. Most of those are children of Mexican and Guatemalan immigrants in this section of North Denver. And we put all those kids in a circle outside. And we put all of our staff there in the circle. And we said to those kids on the first day, if you look at the data from our neighborhood, what we know right now is we should take this half of the circle and send you home. We know that the data says that half of you will never graduate from high school. And of the half that stay, another half of you will never set foot on a college campus or a community college campus. We said, we're here because we believe that something dramatically different than that is possible. If you're willing to show up every day and work hard, we as adults will do whatever it takes to help you get across the finish line. And if you're able to do that, we think that years from now, when you're graduating from high school, people will come from around the city or around the state even, and say, wow, how did these amazing young people pull this off? And that was our promise. Kids thought we were crazy, and parents thought we were crazy, most folks thought we were crazy. But our belief was that there was nothing broken about the kids standing in front of us. There was just something broken about the system we had tried to use to serve them over the past 50 years. So we started down that road. And I use that as an example because there were some key freedoms we had in that school, district public school, that enabled us to be successful along the way. One of the first was we as a team, myself and a team of seven teachers, got to hire every teacher that came into the building. And it was sort of like winning the Rhodes Scholarship. I mean, it was a three-day interview process. You had to do a student hiring interview. You had to do a sample lesson. You had to meet with content area experts. You had to meet with families and kids. And at the end of it, if we thought you were great, we as a team made an offer to you. And there was a real sense that there was a privilege to join this team. When we did that, that meant that the district couldn't, if there was someone that didn't have a position, they couldn't just assign them to our school. You couldn't just force place a student there. And then we spent our time looking meticulously at data. So every 4 weeks, every one of our teachers in every content area, art, science, math, PE, we would give an assessment to our kids. We would start at the beginning of those 4 weeks, lay out what do we want kids to know in 4 weeks. After those 4 weeks, we would assess how much they had grown. The teachers would come and sit down together in our professional development every Wednesday morning and look at that data and say, what kids are really growing, what kids aren't growing, and how are we going to change our instructional practices to make sure they grow the next 4 weeks? All led by teachers, designed by teachers, implemented by teachers, but our belief was we're going to insist on outcomes for these kids, and we'll just keep finding new ways to teach them until we find the ones that work. And that was our overwhelming principle. So when I came to the state Senate, I felt like I had learned some things from the mistakes that we had made and learned some things from the success that we had had. One of the things I learned was that even with those certain amounts of freedoms, it is incredibly hard to successfully turn around a really low-performing school. And I'll be the first to say we're not done yet with our work there. But there were, I would say, five key things we learned, and these became the five key provisions of the bill that we ran in Colorado. The first was our belief was that we had two fundamental responsibilities as an educator. The first one was we wanted to make sure that every young person that walked out of our door was the kind of person you would want to work next to, live next to, be married to, have as a neighbor. We wanted them to be good citizens of the world. We wanted them to be good people. And that was at least a full half of what we did. And I think that half captures all of the intangibles of what makes for great teachers and great principals. That's the teacher who's there at 7 in the morning when there's a kid crying on your doorstep, or there at 3:30 in the afternoon when there's a kid who just still needs more help to master a concept. But the other half of what we do is making sure that kids walk out of our door with a diploma in their hands that gives them the actual skills they're going to need to be successful in the world. And that means the ability to read, write, do math, think critically, solve problems collectively. Those are all critical skills. And so when we took on the task, and when I got to the state Senate, of, well, how would we start by overhauling a teacher and principal evaluation system? Because the first thing was everybody agreed it was broken. We just didn't agree yet on how to fix it. And so we started from the same belief we had at Mesa, which was half of our work is based on building great human beings. Half of our work is based on building kids with the skills they need to be successful. And so we built an evaluation that said 50% of what we do is going to be based on all of the qualitative and subjective measures that come with observing people's practice and watching how they behave with other professionals and colleagues, seeing how they interact with kids and parents. But that half of it will be based on how much more does a student know when she walks out your door on May 30th than she knew when she walked in the door on September 1st. And we believe that that's measurable. And when people would come to me and say, well, maybe that's measurable in language arts or in math, but that's not measurable in art. Ooh, you say that to my art teachers in my school, they would chase you out of the building. Right? Because their belief is we have very clear standards in art. And we have very clear performance metrics for what success on those standards look like. We can debate about how we measure what that performance looks like at the end. But to say that we don't think we can measure that value in art is to say that we don't believe art adds value. And that's something that I deeply disagree with. And so we endeavored to say every teacher, every content area, every grade level, half of your evaluation is based on the subjective measures that are part of you being a great practitioner, and half of them are based on how much you help students master over the time that they're in your classroom. So that was the core of the bill. And then we said those evaluations ought to matter. They ought to mean something. And so they ought to determine, for instance, how you allocate the most significant professional benefit we have in this industry, which is job protections. We don't have $50,000 signing bonuses or top salesman trips to Hawaii in the teaching profession. What we do have are job protections. And so what we said in Colorado is we didn't believe that they needed to be eliminated, but we believe they needed to be earned based on performance and kept based on performance. So if you ever have, whenever you have as a new teacher 3 consecutive years of effective evaluations, you would earn job protections. But those job protections you keep insofar as you're demonstrating you're continuing to be effective. And so if you ever have 2 years of ineffective performance, you lose those job protections. It's not the state's place to say if you're going to be fired or rehired or not. That is a local district and principal and superintendent decision. We're just saying we're not going to provide state-sponsored job protections if you haven't shown that you have a consistent record of great practice. To make tenure really a badge of honor that is earned, so that now every teacher in the state of Colorado who has that badge will know that they earned it based on great performance and they kept it based on great performance. Because under our system, no one is grandfathered in. So if you've been in the profession for 5 years or for 25 years, as of next year, if you don't continue to show positive evaluations and positive impact on kids, you're eligible for losing those job protections. And so that was a driving part of our belief. The other ones are we did things that we never would have, you know, we changed things that we never would have done as a school principal, which is when we had to make layoffs as a school principal, if my job as principal is to put the 27 best educators on the floor for the 574 kids in my building, then I have to make those hard decisions based on who are my 27 best educators. And that means all decisions based on layoffs ought to first be made based on effectiveness, and second, based on seniority, but not the other way around. You think about if the Miami Heat had to lay off 3 players. They're not going to go to LeBron James and say, I'm sorry, LeBron, you've only been on the Heat for 2 years. We have to let you go because Udonis Haslem has been here for 10 years. You're going to say we ought to keep the very best performers on the floor, and if we have an amazing performer who's been here for 25 years and an amazing performer who's been here for 2, then in that case it might make sense that the tie goes to the person with 25 years of institutional memory. But if you have an amazing performer with 2 years of experience and an ineffective performer with 4, there's no reason why a principal or a teacher or a group of educators would make a decision against the more effective of the two. So that was a key part of it. And then we added the policy that, well, we had at Mesa, which was anyone that wants the privilege of walking into my school and serving my kids has to earn that privilege. And they have to earn it the way everybody else did, because you have to apply, you have to meet my kids, you got to teach in front of my class, you got to meet my teachers, and they have to believe that you are worthy of the privilege of teaching next to them. You can't, as a central office, call me and do what happens in many parts of my district, which is, historically, African-American high school in our district, lowest performing one, 80 teachers there, 20 of them resign or retire. The staff and the principal spend a whole spring interviewing candidates who love this district, love this school, love these kids, prepared to hire them. And they call the central office to say, we found our 20 candidates. And they say, oh, yeah, we're sorry about that. We have 20 teachers for whom we can't find placements. So we have to put those 20 teachers in your building. And by the way, they don't want to be there. And by the way, they're all tenured, so they can't be removed. Okay. You do the math on that. In 4 years, you've replaced the entire staff with folks who you've disrespected by putting in a job where they don't want to be, next to other teachers who you've disrespected by putting them next to people who deeply want to be there and asking them to carry the weight for folks who don't. And so we said no. The only people who get hired are folks who principals think are right for the job and who teachers in that building think are right for the job. That's the way it works. And so so we did that. We did evaluations. We did earn and lose tenure. We did last in, first out. We did mutual consent. And last, and I think in some way most important, we said, this is fundamentally about leadership. This is about school leadership. As anyone who's been a teacher before knows, great principals attract and keep great teachers, and bad principals run out great teachers. And so the only way that you are an effective principal in Colorado anymore is now 50% of your evaluation as a principal is linked to how well you do 3 things: recruit great teachers, retain great teachers, and develop novice teachers into becoming great. And so if you can't do that, I don't care how well you supervise lunch or how many football games you've gone to or how much the parents like you. You cannot be a great principal in our state anymore. Because that was the principal I was the first 2 years. It was great. It was like being the mayor of a small town. You just sort of walk around. You talk to kids. You play basketball at lunch. You never show up in a teacher's classroom and actually give them feedback on their instruction. It's an easy job. Turns out that's not the principalship anymore. The principalship is now about how are you the lead instructor in that building who's helping people every day get better at making kids improve. And so we tied every principal's evaluation to the effectiveness of their teachers and said, if you can't help them improve, then all principals in the state are at-will employees in Colorado, so they can be dismissed at any point. But it was critical for us that we linked those two together. And finally, we said one of the benefits of identifying our most highly effective teachers and principals in the state is not that we get to play some game of gotcha and find the low performers. It's that you get to identify who are the very best at this. And now let's unpack what is the magic in their heads that makes them so great. So we established a career ladder system where if you are among the most highly effective teachers or principals, and you choose to, you can apply to one of these career ladders where you earn additional pay and additional responsibility to help share and document all of your best practices. So now if I'm the first year ninth grade English teacher I was, who was, you know, falling asleep fully clothed on my couch at 7 o'clock at night because I don't know what to teach the next day, I could actually go on to, in a couple of years, our Department of Ed website, find ninth grade English, find the standard I'm teaching right now, and up would pop profiles of 10 of the most effective ninth grade English teachers in the state with videos of them teaching the standards I'm teaching, of the lesson plans they've used, of the assessments they've used. So we've taken our great practitioners and made them be the actual lighthouse to help guide the rest of the profession towards excellence. So that was our belief. And I'm gonna stop in a minute so we can get on to the conversation. But that I mentioned the policy because I think it's important in terms of the debate, which is there is nothing more dramatic about this policy than the belief that every single child that walks into a classroom, we believe we as educators are capable of helping improve. Okay. The folks who ultimately at the end of the day disagreed with this policy would say after the first hour of debating with me in my office, but what if you just get some of those kids who really don't care? Or what if you just get some of those kids who really aren't invested? And that if a teacher or a principal got dealt those kids, there just isn't a way to fix that. And that is where I would say this is where we part company. On every other issue, I'll work with you on this. But if it's fundamentally a question of do you believe that there are certain kids that you shouldn't be expected to help improve, then we disagree. But I think the great, great majority of educators in the world are trying every day to find ways to reach those kids. And improvement is sometimes small, but it is improvement. Right? When I ran the alternative high school for 2 years, you know, improvement was the first year we administered the assessment, and David, I'll call him, looked at the assessment, picked it up, threw it in my face, threw a chair at me, called me an MF, and stormed out the door. Right? That was sort of our baseline in year one. In year two, David came in, sat down, did 4 questions, knocked the chair over, and walked out the door. But that's 4 questions, 1 MF, and sort of better than the year before, right? Which is, because I say that because, you know, these were all, in my school I ran there, kids with significantly, what we call SIED, significantly identifiable emotional disabilities. These are kids with serious, serious mental illnesses, serious histories of trauma and abuse. And the assumption is always, well, for those kids, we ought not to worry. And we said the opposite. We said, no, for those kids, we ought to worry the most. And so that was where this played out, I think, was defending that belief system. So I'll close by telling you a story, which is one of the proudest nights of my life. Not the day this bill was passed and not the day this bill was signed. It was 2 weeks ago. And the group of 6th graders that we recruited 7 years ago to start our first class at Mesa. So the group of 6th graders that were there the first day that we had those kids out in the circle saying, we think something dramatically different is possible. And those 6th graders, 55 of them, 100% of them graduating from high school, 100% of them admitted to 4-year colleges. And better than that, the first graduating class we had 3 years before also 100% graduated. also 100% admitted to four-year colleges. And that night we went out, we thought we were done. The teachers and I, we thought we were the best thing ever. And then 2 days later, we started getting phone calls from those kids who graduated who said, oh, yeah, my boyfriend really wants me to move in with him, and I think I'm going to do that just for a while. I'm going to work at Subway. We're going to figure it out. Or, oh, my mom really needs me to be at home. And what we found is that those kids who we had worked so hard to get from 7th grade or 10th grade across the graduation stage, once they walked off the stage, they still needed the support we had given them. So only 30% of that first group of kids, a year out, were finishing their first year of college successfully. And so the night that we had that great triumph, we sat down as a team of teachers and said, wow, this isn't good enough. Our data tells us this isn't good enough. Our counselor won the Colorado Counselor of the Year that year. She came back the next Monday and said, we got to meet because this isn't good enough. So this class now, after 3 years ago, the first group was 30%, and I left. The next group, 60% of those kids finished the end of freshman year on track for sophomore year. The third year, 80% of those kids finished a year out, finished their freshman year on track to be sophomores. The lesson there, one, is when you get rid of an ineffective leader, things get much better. But the second lesson was our teachers were so dissatisfied until we actually delivered the results that meant we had really changed kids' lives that even in the moments when we had a partial win, they said, that's not good enough. And we went back and kept looking at the data and kept finding ways to fix it and kept looking for resources to deliver until we got to the stage where now when this group of sixth graders walked across the stage, we knew they, for the first time, probably had a real chance not just that all of them would graduate high school, not just that all of them would actually get admitted to college or that all of them might start college, but that all of them actually might finish college. And that was a promise that they thought was crazy. And their parents thought were crazy, and our colleagues thought were crazy. But it was the relentless insistence on high expectations for every kid and the refusal to take any excuses along the way that was what delivered that for those kids. And that was the result solely of amazing educators who did that over time with great commitment. And so the positive part of this story is we now know that there is the transformative opportunity for every kid in this city. We're in this state. And it's not a new curriculum. It's not a new computer program. It's not a new set of tests. It is long-term commitment to recruiting great teachers and principals, retaining great teachers and principals, and developing novice ones to be great. If we can do that, we all, I think, stand a fighting chance of being able to say that we were the generation that finally delivered on the old, old American promise that we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all are created equal. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you very much, Mike. I'm going to introduce our moderator and our panel, and I will, the problem with getting such esteemed guests and panelists and moderators is that they have very long bios that we have to break down here, so. We are pleased again to have Mr. Matt Tully with us this evening. Matt is going to be the moderator of our panel. And before I introduce Matt, let me introduce first our panelists. In the middle, we have Mr. David Dressler. Dave is with Cell, and I can use it with you, but not with Sandy, right? That was the deal we cut. Dave is the executive director of the Center of Excellence in Leadership of Learning at the University of Indianapolis, which is CEL. He has been there since 2008, previously a senior fellow for CEL with primary responsibility for high school innovation and model school development. Before joining CEL in 2004, Dr. Dressler served as a superintendent of schools in Michigan for 17 years, and prior to that in a variety of teaching and administrative positions, including assistant superintendent of Lawrence Township Schools here in Indianapolis. In addition to leading CEL as it serves for the schools and students of Indiana, Dave writes and speaks on school transformation and the future of educational practices. In 2011, Dr. Dressler was named to the Who's Who in Education by the Indianapolis Business Journal. To Dave's right is Mindy Schlegel. Mindy is a dear friend of mine and many of us in our organization. Mindy recently joined Great Schools Organization to build a local Indianapolis program. This is a program that helps educate parents in the multitude of school choices throughout Marion County. She was recently with the Indiana Department of Education, where she led policy around educator effectiveness and leadership. While there, she helped define and implement policies on accountability and school turnaround, specifically on educator evaluation and compensation. Mindy was an instrumental part of Senate Bill 1, if you're familiar with that legislation. In the past year, she led the statewide evaluation pilot for the state's model system, RISE, and other three locally developed evaluation systems. Along with writing legislative guidance and presenting to superintendents and school boards across the state, Mindy has a deep understanding of local implementation of many of the education reforms passed in 2011. Mindy began her career as Teach for America Corps in Houston, Texas, and has had a long esteemed career in education, and I know her as a tremendous mother as well. So, Mindy Schlegel. And on the other side, we'll use Dave as our reference point here. On the left side of Dave is Dr. Sandy Cole, who's not with Cell.
The other Cell.
She is with the other Cell. And we thank you, Sandy. Sandy was able to join us at the last minute as we were desperately seeking another panelist and agreed to join us here. So we are pleased to have you as well as our other panelists. Dr. Cole is the director of the Center of Education and Lifelong Learning, and to me that spells CEL, but apparently not, at the Indiana Institute on Disability and Community at IU. Prior to joining the university, Dr. Cole spent 22 years as a public school teacher and administrator at both elementary and secondary levels. Her areas of expertise include collaboration and teaming, school change and redesign, strategic planning, school-wide discipline, and instructional approaches for diverse learners. Additionally, Dr. Cole has conducted numerous program evaluations for schools and districts and is a faculty member in the Indiana University Graduate School and an adjunct professor in the School of Education. She's consulted extensively with school districts across the country in designing schools that are inclusive of all students. We're pleased to have you with us this evening. And then last but certainly not least, our esteemed leader of our panel here, Matt Tully is, to many of you, is a familiar columnist with the Indianapolis Star. He's been there for 20 years. I find that hard to believe. 20, 10 and 10. Okay.
It was hard to believe.
All right. It feels like 20. I'm aging Matt as we sit here. Yes, 2002 would be 10 years. My math background tells me that. Matt has had a diverse set of assignments from Gary, Indiana to Capitol Hill before joining the Star in 2002. You've been a journalist for 20 years. That's where we missed the connection. His assignments have ranged from search for a serial killer in Northwest Indiana to congressional reaction to the attacks of September 11th. Matt writes three columns each week on issues ranging from politics to crime and focuses heavily on education issues, as I'm sure many of you recognize. His columns on public schools have helped drive debate over education reform in Indiana, and Matt's commentary has appeared in the Wall Street Journal, Education Week, and he has appeared on MSNBC and NPR and numerous other national media outlets. Among many other national awards, he has been named Indiana Journalist of the Year in 2008 and won the Casey Medal for Excellence in Journalism in 2010. And I meant to bring your book as a prop. I have my two orders at home. Matt recently wrote the book Searching for Hope, which is based on the year he spent at Manual High School. And I know many of us followed his ventures there as he chronicled it in his column. That book is out, and I'm sure Matt can refer you where you can find copies of that. He's a graduate of Indiana University, lives in Indianapolis with his wife and son. Welcome, Matt. The podium is all yours.
Good evening, everyone. I look forward to your questions. I have my iPhone, so you can tweet them to me, too, and I'll ask them that way. I'll just get the conversation started. Senator Johnson, you laid out a picture of reform in your state. in the average school, say in Denver, how close is the reality to what you'd like to see and what the legislation proposes?
I think one of the things that's been key about our legislation is that we've been trying to do it right as opposed to do it fast. And so we've, you know, when you take a question like, how are you going to evaluate student growth in second grade art? It's a complicated question. And so what we've done is we've had a time frame over the last year and a half, we've had a governor's council, which has been working on answering the questions of what does it mean to be an effective teacher and a principal and how do you measure it? And right now we have teams of teachers across the state who are working on developing what they think the right set of assessments are for each of those content areas. So the elementary art teachers are meeting to propose that. And so we will start piloting all of our evaluation systems and that come along with those definitions next year. So we started a pre-pilot this year, which I think was very positive, and districts had really great responses to it. But we'll see next year our first pilot implementation without any stakes attached. And the year after that, we go live with stakes. And so we're still very deep in the implementation, which has been the nuts and bolts of working with teachers and principals. And I would say, actually, I think we've done better even on the collaboration and the depth on the implementation than we did in some ways in the policy. So I think we acknowledge it'd be a gradual process, and we're in that right now.
Stephen Brill was in town recently to talk about his book, and one argument he makes is that you have to have the right systems in place because you can't expect this country to produce 3.2 million or whatever the number is, top-notch, stellar teachers. Your plan obviously kind of disputes that. It makes the case that you need top teachers in every classroom. What do you say to folks who make that argument that maybe it's a little too much to ask to have so many great teachers?
I mean, I think it's a both and, right? I mean, I think that it is, there's a Reed Hastings, who's the Netflix CEO and the California Board of Ed, says there's not a shortage of high-quality teachers. There's a shortage of high-quality work environments where teachers want to teach. Which is to say, you know, anybody is better when they play on a great team. You know, I could actually be okay even playing for the Colts if there were 10 good people around me. And so I wouldn't get the ball a lot, but I would be on the field. And so I think what we're finding is high-performing schools and high-performing networks of schools make the preconditions such that it's easier to be an effective teacher. You don't have to be, you know, I say that I think that sometimes the great career teachers that we have are like, you know, roses that have grown up through the cement. And so they have amazing will to do that. What we want to do is create hothouses where it's actually easy to grow those roses by the dozens. And so I think it's both. You have to both attract great talent, but you also have to give them reasonable job descriptions and supportive work environments where they can really succeed. Because I think now they feel like they're salmon swimming upstream.
If we walked into the average classroom in a public school in Colorado and walked up to a teacher and said, what do you think of the senator's plan that's being implemented, how much buy-in is there, and if it's been bought into, how did you get that done?
It's easier for me to go into that classroom now than it was 2 years ago, I'll tell you that. I was the first sitting Democrat that the NEA ever ran radio ads against, so you know, there was definitely I knew because one of my students texted me and was like, Johnston, I heard you did something really terrible, like I just heard about you on the radio, you know, it was like, call Senator Johnson and tell him to stop eating your children. But then what I found is we actually went out and sat down, and I spent, you know, the last year or so just going to classrooms and sitting down with groups of teachers after school and talking through what was in the bill, what wasn't in the bill, what was misunderstood, what they thought were improvements we could make. And now I think that and both of the unions as well as the other stakeholders have been integral partners on this governor's council for the last year and a half, so we've worked very closely together. I'll say we had the final rules for this that the state board approved to implement this bill just about a month ago. And I testified jointly with the president of the teachers union that opposed the bill, the head of the Metro Chamber of Commerce, and my Republican co-sponsor. All four of us testified unanimously in favor of the rules. And so I think that we've seen even better collaboration on implementation than before. And so I think there's still some trepidation about what this will look like because it's going to be new. But I think there's now much more of a sense that teachers are going to be involved in it and own it than there might have been 2 years ago.
So for states that maybe are a little further behind in the process, what have you learned? What mistakes did you make that other states could learn from?
I think, fortunately, some of the mistakes that, you know, some of the mistakes that I made, other people fixed through the process. And so there were some things, like I originally didn't want the three-year timeline rollout. I think that turned out to be really wise to have that. I think the two things that we
that we did the best on were, one is this group of this content collaborative, which are groups of teachers from around the state helping us identify assessments. Because really what it came down to is the biggest fear was about, will the assessment be fair? You know, I think most teachers would say, yeah, of course. I want my students, I'm open to being accountable for my teachers growing. The question is just how you measure whether my students have grown, because I might think they've grown and your test doesn't show that they have. And so the greatest friction point was always, is the assessment fair, because all the consequences follow from those. And so I think getting real collaboration and buy-in on the development of the assessment, having time to pilot it well, and then I think having an ongoing advisory group that has all stakeholders at the table, teachers, principals, superintendents, parents, students, business leaders, that's been really helpful. I think those have been our best lessons so far.
I'll start with Mindy, but anyone else wants to jump in on this one. For the audience, when you hear about Colorado's plan, and I'm sure you've read about it, how would you compare Indiana's legislation to that?
Yeah, so it's fairly similar. I think we went about a couple of things slightly differently, and they played out in some interesting ways. One of the things, I mean, he talked about, you know, things you think you want, and then they play out differently. One of the things we really debated on is the 50% data. Did we really want to put a percentage on that? And where we landed was really to make it flexible for districts, to provide a state model that districts can look at and use, but really to leave it up to local decision making. What's been fascinating is that the majority of districts have really followed what the state model has been doing, but they've been doing it on their own. So it was far less a top-down approach, and that has just been really fascinating to see play out. You know, Colorado took the route of a career ladder. Indiana did some work around compensation. So we changed the way that teachers are able to earn raises, really creating more avenues other than, you know, it's typically a two-tier system, right? It's years and experience. And what we had lots of discussions around with legislators was around providing opportunities for teachers to earn raises based on actual work that they did. So not just existing in a building for an additional year, but are they having leadership positions? Are they highly effective teachers or effective teachers? All those things are still bargainable in Indiana. So those items are discussed and bargained through the collective bargaining process. But we just sort of opened up the avenues for more opportunities for teachers to earn those raises.
Anyone else want to jump on that one?
She's the expert.
Okay. Well, maybe David and Sandy, real quick, if you want to give your thoughts on the Indiana plan, where it works, where it doesn't.
Let me first of all just say that one of the things that I've been involved in extensively this year is something called INTAS, and it's a process that we created at the other cell using the framework from Evanston, Illinois, and District 65's teacher evaluation, teacher appraisal process. And what we did was we decided that it wasn't really about the model, it was about a process. And we were concerned, to be honest with you, not about the state's model necessarily as much as we were concerned about districts adopting the model without going through a process around decisions relative to that model. And as Mindy said, the value, I think the strength in the Indiana model is the flexibility. It provides a framework, it provides guidance, but, and the joke actually among us at INTAS was that every time I would call Mindy, or not every time, but often when I would call Mindy, she would say, that's a local decision. And so because it was a local decision, we believe that it was really important that districts engage in a process. And that's why we created INTAS. That's why I'm passionate about INTAS. And much of it follows the change literature, which says that people need to own and have internal capacity and internal systems in order to actually implement something with fidelity. And so we are, in Indiana, we're at a stage where we are currently having districts create these plans. I think for us, the most critical piece is how well those plans get implemented with fidelity. And so that's why I think that the process is really critical. the state gave us a good model. I think we just applied the process to that.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think Sandy really sort of hit on it. What we tried to do at the state level was to create some guardrails that we thought were important. So our priorities were annual, that included data, that, you know, teachers were placed in this sort of four summative ratings so that we could measure serve statewide. But then really let local decisions happen at the local level and then provide supports from the state in terms of a model and then lots of legislative guidance, but really let the discussions happen at the local level.
Okay. I'll address your question, Matt, from more of a personal standpoint. I conducted my first teacher evaluation more than 30 years ago. And during the past 30 years, teacher evaluation has been low stakes, not just in Indiana, but in every state. And low stakes in terms of not a lot of expectation with regard to the quality or rigor of the evaluation, and not a lot of consequence as to the result of the evaluation. I am guilty of having talked to teachers about their classroom appearance, about their student behavior, not concentrating on instruction. But when I was trained as a school administrator, teacher evaluation was not a part of the curriculum. It was not a part of the expectation. It was something that was more of a routine accomplishment that needed to be taken care of. And of course, as an administrator in a school, I, like many of my colleagues, had an obligation and a desire to get along with my staff. And in low-stakes settings such as that, where there wasn't that expectation, it was rather easy to have evaluations that lacked rigor. I think that we have seen a fundamental shift in education that could be the most important reform of all the reforms that have taken place in Indiana and across the land in terms of accountability as expressed through teacher evaluation. I think it's going to change the entire landscape. A good example of that is I don't think you'll see a salary schedule in Indiana in 5 years. I don't think one teacher will be paid on a salary schedule. We paid teachers on salary schedules, which were years of service and academic degrees, because that's all we knew. We didn't have student test results. We didn't have growth. We didn't have observations that were based on rubrics. We didn't have well-trained school administrators, and this isn't an accusation or an indictment. This is the way it has been. And so the shift to high-stakes teacher evaluation, where teacher evaluation must include student performance, where teacher evaluation must include contract renewal and pay, that's going to create the expectation for administrators that they better know what they're doing. Because if they do the same kinds of teacher evaluations that I'm guilty of having done, they will be sued and they will lose. And the teachers will prevail because those evaluations will not hold up in court. And now that there's a property value with teacher evaluation in terms of pay and contract renewal, you can be sure that this will be litigated if it's not done well. So I'm encouraged. As a longtime observer of education and education reform, I think this is the most significant thing that we have to look for in the future. And you might ask, well, what are we going to pay teachers based on? We're going to pay them the way everyone else in our society is paid, and that is based on their performance. And how are we going to pay teachers when they come in? We're going to do it the way everyone else is paid, and that is if I'm hiring a physics teacher and a PE teacher, and I apologize if there are PE teachers in the audience, very important. By the way, this fly only arrived when I started to speak.
Me too.
And he's not going to go away. So this is, we'll be up here doing this, unless someone can draw him to them. We're going to pay that physics teacher more. Why would we pay individuals that are in high demand the same as we pay individuals that are in low demand? Because we have a schedule. Will we pay our third grade teachers that get a year's growth out of our kids the same as we pay our third grade teachers that get 2 years' growth out of our kids? Shouldn't. We should pay the teachers that get 2 years' growth more. as Michael said, the devil is in the measurement of that performance. But I think with training, good rubrics, reliable and trustworthy growth models, I think we can do it, and I think it will set the tone for education in the future.
Senator Johnson, how fair can a process be of evaluating employees? Most professions, there's some subjectivity in the boss's evaluation of their employees. How fair should we expect this process to be, and how fair can it be?
It's a great question. One of the reasons why I think that this balance between what I'll call the subjective parts of evaluation and the growth component is so important is because it balances out against the subjectivity of current evaluations, right? I heard a lot from teachers around the state about how they felt like they really had principals who didn't have the skills to do good evaluations or who didn't come through and do evaluations and or didn't like them because they spoke up in faculty meetings or because they dated their sister and she dumped them. I mean, sort of the stories are all out there. And the risk is, I would remind those folks, is that if you go back to the old system, 100% of your evaluation is subjective. So when your sister dumps the principal, there's nothing to keep the principal from giving you a 0 on a scale to 4 under the old system. I'm a football fan, and so we used in Colorado at that time, before he got traded, I used to call it the Brandon Marshall problem. Right? If you know Brandon Marshall, he is an incredibly gifted wide receiver for the Broncos, who also has some real personality problems. Right? But when you catch 1,400 yards of footballs a year and 13 touchdowns, as a head coach, you better have a darn good reason if you're going to trade Brandon Marshall. Because I don't care how much you don't like the way he behaves in team meetings. If he's generating those results, he's really valuable for the city. If there's a teacher who's really difficult at faculty meetings, but when that door closes, she's getting amazing results with kids, that principal's sure going to have to figure out how she can work with her before she lets her go. So, I think that the data now currently says that the measures on standardized test improvements are slightly more reliable than batting averages in Major League Baseball. Now, are Major League batting averages infallible? No, but they certainly drive a whole lot of significant decision-making year to year. And so I think we'll get, through the combination of quantitative and qualitative, I think we'll get the best picture we can, but I think that picture is always going to be improving.
What do you say to those who say you're asking too much of teachers, that they got into this profession to teach, and now they're being told you're the most important factor in whether this kid succeeds or fails, and some people say, boy, you're just asking too much of people making $50,000 a year.
I want to, actually, the compensation is another issue I'd love to talk about. But the way I see it is this is actually us inverting the pyramid, which is right now I think you have a system where kids are at the bottom and then teachers and then principals and area superintendents and everyone serves the person above them, right? The principal kind of does the things that are going to make the area superintendent happy. I think this now flips the entire pyramid, where now students are the single most important variable. And how well they do is what matters the most in the district. And teachers are on the front line trying to give those kids what they need. And so their job is to support kids. A principal's job is now fully to get the teachers the resources they need to be effective with the kids. So now instead of teachers coming to principals saying, hey, can I really have this? And principals saying no. In effective systems under our framework, you should have principals going to teachers saying, hey, what do you need? Like, what can I get you to help make this class run more effectively? Do you need more resources? Do you need a para? And so our goal is by linking this whole system to the student outcomes, we've now flipped it where the people that used to be up the food chain now actually serve the folks that are doing more direct service. So our hope is that this action, I think you're seeing this in some schools and charter schools around the country. Right now, as a principal, I mean, I have to fight to keep great teachers because there are 50 other places they'd rather go. And so I think we're creating a system where it's more about what leadership can do to create environments where teachers want to teach, as opposed to there being an old world abusive system where teachers are neglected. And so I'm hoping that this actually empowers them to really drive the system.
Maybe you could start, and anyone else who wants to jump in on the teacher pay issue, you had some thoughts on that.
This is another one of my crazy ideas, but since there's a couple already out there, I'll add this one as well. So I think that there are two ways that you raise the status of a profession. I think what we want to do is raise the status of the teaching so it is among the highest status professions in America. I think the two ways you can do it are you can increase the compensation for that profession, or you can increase the selectivity for that profession. And so challenge for us on the state budget front is if you want to do compensation first, that's about a third of our state budget. So say to take teachers from $30,000 a year to $60,000 a year starting salary is about a $2 billion proposition in Colorado. We'd have to have the voters pay for those taxes. I'm a soccer player, so you know if you come to Colorado and you see the Colorado Rapids play, their starting left halfback makes $44,000 a year, less than the average teacher salary in our district. But if you walk into a bar on a Friday night or a soccer field on a Friday afternoon or the library, he's a pretty big deal, right? Because even though the compensation may not be high for that profession, the selectivity is incredibly high. There's only one starting left halfback in all of Denver for the Colorado Rapids. And so my belief is you have to first increase the selectivity of the profession as a way to then drive an increase in compensation, because I think we can't get compensation first without increasing the selectivity. On the selectivity front, I think the way that you drive increased selectivity is, you know, to increase selectivity, as universities know, you can either reduce the number of people that you admit or you can increase the applicant pool. We can't reduce the number of teachers that we hire because we're going to need more and more. So I think the only way to drive selectivity is to increase the applicant pool, is to make sure that if you are a Phi Beta Kappa physics graduate from the Colorado School of Mines, I cannot hire you to teach science at my high school. Barack Obama loses this election, I could not hire him to teach high school history at my public school. Universities could, private schools could, charters could. So I think the more that you allow principals, and that's built in because no one believed that principals had the capacity to make those decisions. So if you build in a system where you say, we're going to give schools and teams of teachers and principals the power to hire who they think the best person is for that job and train them in the way that that school teaches and runs their own instructional program, we'll give them that freedom. If they're not successful, we'll let them go. I think then you dramatically increase the number of applicants, which means you dramatically increase the selectivity, and now being the ninth grade English teacher is something like being the starting left halfback for the Colorado Rapids.
Mindy, is there anything in Indiana's law that's going to change the way teachers are compensated?
Yeah, so I mentioned a little bit of it earlier, and I would say this is probably, I mean, you all can pipe in, this is probably the thing that is most feared among teachers. It's a little bit of a black box. I mean, for someone who's been teaching, a veteran teacher who's used to lockstep, knew what they were going to be making in 20 years, this is quite a scary prospect. So districts have the flexibility now to collectively bargain salaries in an entirely different way. They decide the percentages, and they decide locally how leadership is defined and how academic needs is defined. So at Mike's school, academic needs might be a really great art teacher or a really great music teacher, and he wants to pay that person more because that's what their curriculum mandates. At Sandy's school, it may be that she has a real need for special ed teachers. She wants to offer them more money. That's how she defines academic needs for her students. So we allowed the school districts and individual schools to sort of define what that need was at the local level. It's going to be really interesting to see new contracts in the next year come about. So this is really the first time they're starting to negotiate and define what those things will be, and then how that plays out with the current pot of money. So they didn't, it's not, you know, we often hear it referred to in the newspapers as, sorry, Matt, merit pay. And, you know, it's really much more, we've been trying to call it performance pay. So it's taking the same, merit pay to me is an extra bonus on top of your salary. So what we tried to redesign was how we allocate the same amount of money in different ways for things that actually really matter to teachers, schools, and kids. So I think it's going to be very interesting, but it's definitely the thing that is most, I think the evaluation concerns have, at least through the pilot, have really died down, but they can't get around conversations around how the pay is going to be structured. It's just making people very nervous.
Sandy?
I think I want to go to the fair issue, because to me that's been my response to, in the districts that we're working with, to the fear around compensation. You know, there, to say that our past system was fair would be so off base. When I was a principal and I looked down my second grade hallway at my seven second grade teachers, they got paid based on how many years they breathed, and they got paid based on their education. And it really didn't matter what they did from the time school started to the time school ended. So when I talk to teachers, and in our process, we talk a lot about teacher certainty. because in this whole change, teachers have to be certain about the assessments that are going to be used for growth. They have to be certain about the rubrics, about the practice evaluation and observation. They have to be certain, which means they have to be at the table for the decision-making process. But beyond that, they have to be certain about what is an effective teacher. And quite frankly, in the past, there has not been any certainty around what an effective teacher is and therefore how they get compensated accordingly. So back to the FAIR issue, I think this shift, and it is a shift, and it will take some time to shift, and it really will be dependent on how well we implement this change with some fidelity. But this shift, I think, will bring so much more certainty for teachers around what they do, why they do it, what's important to do, how effective is measured and defined, and ultimately then what they get compensated for in terms of performance. So I think that it really is bringing some needed value and some fairness to our system.
David?
I agree with what Mindy and Sandy have said, but and also Michael. I would only add that there's an assumption that teachers see safety and comfort in the salary schedule, and that that they don't. And there's also an assumption that all teachers don't want to see that go, and they don't want to see performance-based compensation. I don't think that's true. I think a lot of teachers resent the salary schedule. I think a lot of teachers resent the fact that indeed they make the same as their hallmates who aren't doing the job. And I think, frankly, I think the people that see safety and comfort in the salary schedule are maybe the people that that we don't want to encourage to continue in the profession, and the people that that see performance-based compensation for what it is, and that is giving them credit for the hard work that they do, are the people that we want to keep in the system. Now, that sounds kind of harsh, but I think there are a lot of young teachers out there that are making significantly less than their older peers, and I'm not on a campaign against old people, being one. I think they kind of resent that, and I think what we're going to see, yes, they are concerned about this salary change, but I think we're going to see much more receptivity amongst the teachers that we want to reward than you might otherwise imagine.
Senator Johnson, you talked a lot about arts programs and the school that you're at, taking them very seriously, and that they would recoil at the idea that they didn't see value in that. But as states and districts move to a system where they're held more accountable for test scores and data, what do you do to make sure principals don't back away from these other programs because they know how they're being judged, and that's not on arts and music and welding?
There are state accountability metrics for schools' progress, then there are teacher level and principal levels. And so in Colorado now, our teacher level metrics will be for every content area and grade level. So we will, there is not a sense that, because I think in other systems where you say we're only going to do evaluations for English and math teachers based on growth, but not for art or science, I think those teachers feel like their content area is less valued. The math and English teachers feel like they're on the hook for something high stakes and the other teachers aren't. And so there are a couple ways districts in our state have gone about that. One is that they, and we put this in the law, they can allocate shared responsibility among all teachers for the state metrics. So if it's language arts and math, that a part of a science teacher's assessment is going to be student success in language arts and math, because many schools like ours would believe that every teacher in the building is a teacher of reading. And so we're all helping develop literacy skills. So that's why we tried to push more or towards more well-rounded metrics to say, let's measure more than language arts and math. We're going to build a science and a social studies assessment in our state that will be part of the accountability system. So it is a statewide standardized assessment in those two content areas. Because I think those were the content areas that we saw pushed out the fastest, and social studies probably chief among those because it gets beaten out by language arts. So we've expanded our accountability framework to include science and social studies. But our hope is that the real focus on teacher-level data makes all the content areas matter.
You said when someone suggests to you that certain kids just aren't capable of achieving, that that ends the conversation. But it's a big piece of the counter-argument to the reforms that those of you on the panel have pushed. What do you say to those folks who say, hey, certain kids just aren't capable of achieving at the same level, and this school isn't going to ever be as good as a school 30 minutes north in the suburbs?
Sure. Yeah, I probably said that. I didn't mean to say that the conversation ends. I'm just saying that becomes the hardest part to negotiate, because there really is now an ideological divide. In other places, it's more technical fixes. I think the key part of this for Colorado, and this gets sort of wonky, but for Colorado, we have a system called the Colorado Growth Model, which many states now emulate.
Indiana
has ours, great. And so the benefit of our system and your system is that all of the growth model metrics are built off of cohorts of similarly performing students. And so what that means is, if you're looking at how much did I grow last year, if you take David, the sample student I gave you, when you're looking at David's performance, who is the student with a significant emotional disability, he is compared to other students with similar performance histories. So you're looking at the other kids that for the last 4 years have never answered a single question on the state test because they've thrown it into the trash. And so the idea, it means that you're not saying, how did David compare to the IB student in the suburban school? We are saying we expect him to grow, but there is a cohort effect of, A, looking at growth. So we're not saying, if you're on this slope of line, we're not saying where you ended up, but wherever you started on that slope, how far did you move across it? And then how does that relate to the way other students with similar performance histories have fared? And so once I talk that through with teachers, I think that significantly reduces their tension. I will say one thing that was a big debate in our state was first special ed, which I think that was a mistake that I made that a special ed teacher caught for us, which is the nature of having a processing delay is that you process information at a different rate. And so if you're looking at this slope, it may not just be that you came in here. It may mean that if you have a processing delay, your slope of acquisition actually looks like this, right? Because the rate at which you take in information is different. So we do have different growth expectations for special ed students, but if there are any special ed teachers in the crowd? Okay, well, if you talk to them, yeah. I mean, we've been doing this for 30 years, right, with IEPs. Like, the special ed teachers are better at this than anybody because they every year set growth goals for kids and they're accountable. Our debate was about English language learners and whether or not they should have a separate growth expectation. I fought hard that they should not, and so we kept that because our belief is that's not a processing issue, that's a language issue. So I think for most people, the more we talked through that issue, the more they felt like that apples-to-apples comparison was more fair. Interestingly, the people who really fought this at the end were the people that represented the schools that were 98% proficient. So the wealthiest suburban districts would come in and say, this isn't fair, because our kids are so smart, they can't get any smarter. And then the poorest districts would come in and say, this is no fair, our kids are so far behind, they'll never catch up. The beauty of the growth model is it accounts for that, right? Because you're looking at other kids that are also in the 95th percentile.
Maybe all of you can answer this question. And we have time for more questions if you want to send them up. I will say, I think Indiana got rid of cursive. I advocate for that too. Having a little trouble with some of the cursive questions. What are the weaknesses in Colorado's law, and then for the rest of you in Indiana's law?
So quick start. I want to add to my earlier question of what did we fail on. The one thing I really wanted in the law that did not get in was I wanted principals' evaluations to be linked 70% to student growth and teachers 50%. My belief was if you're going to lead this program in this school, you ought to be the farthest one out on saying I'm ready to be accountable for data and I will lead in that way. So that was one battle that I lost that I wish we hadn't. The things that I think that you all...
Did you lose that battle?
The politics of the Principals Association. So there was the principals and the superintendents couldn't get there, and I couldn't get the votes to get them there. I think the things that you all did that we didn't touch, which I think are great, are looking at the requirement that you don't have a student placed in consecutive multiple years with an ineffective teacher. And we didn't do it because we worried that not every district would have that capacity. If you're in a rural district in Colorado with only 80 kids in the district, there's only one math teacher at the high school. But I thought what you all came up with, which was great, was if that's your situation, you have to at least notify parents that we don't have anyone else to teach your kid, and so your child will be assigned to an ineffective educator the second year in a row. So I think that was an area that we were weaker on that you all, I thought, really broke trail on. I think that's the big one for us. We also, I think, we may learn this as a mistake. We, as a concession, which we thought would be great, is we created what we call a portable tenure, which is now if you earn tenure in one district, our belief is that now you've earned it on a standardized system. You've earned it based on real student growth. So if you earn it in Gary and want to move to IPS, you could carry that with you. And what we're going to find is teachers and principals alike are going to ask us to undo that, because I think what we wanted was for that principal, for that teacher to have an advantage in the hiring pool, for her to be a sought-after entity. We think it may actually do the opposite, which is it may make her at a disadvantage in hiring because the principal sees you as someone that you have to assign a three-year contract to instead of one. So I think that's something that we're watching we may have to fix.
Mindy, what's the missing piece in Indiana as well?
I have a funny story about the two ineffective teachers in a row. I was pinned down in a room with a bunch of HR folks. They have a big convention in the spring, and that question came up. You know, I'm a rural Indiana HR person, and I have this one. You know, this is going to create a real issue for me. And I was about to open my mouth, and another HR person stood up and said, "Well, then you better do your job and make sure you don't get into that situation." And it was just this beautiful moment where I didn't even have to answer. I would say that's a tough question. We did a similar thing with status. Indiana doesn't really have tenure, but we have status, and the status changes in the bill are very similar to Colorado, where if you are a new teacher, you can earn and then get bumped down based on effectiveness. But we did grandfather in everyone who was employed as of last July, and that was a long debate, and I think it weakened a little bit, sort of differentiating teachers who, you know, on sort of a random date when the bill was passed. And so that's when I go to meet with teachers and principals, it's a little difficult to explain the differences and then sort of the HR processes that you go through based on evaluation. So I would say that's, for me, been the trickiest part to explain to districts and principals.
I think there are a couple of things missing. They both cost money, and that's probably the explanation as to why they're missing. Professional development is missing. Teacher evaluation is half the step. The other half is professional development. If you do a really good job of evaluating teachers, you're using a Danielson model, you have a rubric, you know the domains, you know the indicators, you've trained your principals, and you identify weaknesses in classroom practice, without I also providing professional development to ameliorate those weaknesses, you've only done half the step. The teacher deserves not only to know what the weaknesses are, but the teacher deserves to know how can I make up for those weaknesses through professional development. So I think that's missing. It is expensive, but I think it's an expectation that we should have for schools and districts. The other thing is capacity. I think we are putting a huge burden on our principals, our building principals throughout the state with regard to the evaluation law. They have a lot of work to do. They are managing the building. They are being the instructional leader. And so capacity can be multiplied in buildings by allowing teachers to do peer evaluations. I think peers can be the most effective evaluators in buildings. And so releasing teachers into peer roles where they're master or mentor teachers that can provide evaluation assistance, I think that's going to be a real critical factor with regard to the Indiana success in evaluation, and that is, will our principals have not only the training, which I've talked about earlier, but also the capacity to do it?
I would have to underscore the professional development piece with a big red line 30 times. I think that it is the the thing that could make or break this in terms of implementation. We've got to really help teachers know that if they fall into that needs improvement category, that we're not writing them off, that we're saying, we want to help you, we want to support you, and here's how. And we have to be willing to use the data that this system is going to give us. This system is going to give us some invaluable data that you can disaggregate by school, across the district, to say, in what ways are our teachers strong and in what ways are they weak? And that should drive a professional development plan in every district. I like to think that there are districts right now that understand that. There are also some districts who do what I call random acts of improvement, which is, you know, it's the latest mm-hmm. act of professional development that's not tied to anything. And so we have an opportunity now to tie it to something that's valuable and that will improve teaching. And so we've got to support that in a number of ways, and I think the state can be creative around that. The second piece that I think is missing, but I think can also be something that as this unravels, unfolds in the next couple of years can be looked at. Mindy and I have actually talked a little bit about this, and that's the monitoring piece. And I don't mean monitoring by the state for sanctions, but rather monitoring for quality of implementation. And what concerns me a little bit is that you can be compliant with this law and hand a plan in July 1 and go like this and say, okay, we're done. And this can't end there because it's too important, and we've got to figure out a way that we collectively, meaning the state and other entities, create rubrics that identify quality plans and quality implementation so that we really have models around the state for people to look at, and we can provide the professional development to those districts who are not implementing a quality evaluation plan. Because if I'm a teacher, and I say this to my undergrads, if I'm interviewing next year in a district, you should interview that district about what is your evaluation plan, because I don't want to go somewhere that isn't a quality plan. So I think we've got to find a way to monitor plans for quality of implementation.
We're down to about 4 minutes, so I say a little lightning round here. I'll be quick with my questions, if you guys can be quick with the answers. I'll start on the end with Sandy.
I feel like I'm in a political debate.
Do you think with so much, these are questions from the audience, do you think with so much of the Indiana model being a local decision that the inconsistency between schools is going to become a weak spot in the future?
I think that underscores the need for some monitoring around the implementation. And I think it's a benefit, but it could also end up being a problem. So we've got to figure out a way to monitor that.
David, how can we pull in higher education so that they are more committed to supporting kids who come from poverty, that they are actually able to get their four-year degree?
That's a lightning round question.
20
words or
less.
10 seconds.
I think we are seeing higher education respond like they never have before. The pressure's on. And I really can't give a comprehensive question to that or answer to that question.
You can have 30
other
seconds.
Than to say higher education is now paying attention to K-12, and I think we'll see good results from that.
Mindy, did you want to jump in on that one?
I was just going to add really quickly that, sure. that along with this teacher evaluation sort of and principal evaluation, I should say, like, they are paired together in the bill, that we are now holding higher ed accountable and prep programs. I mean, it's not done yet, but that's the direction, which I think is helping to light some fire under.
Okay. I agree.
Well, Mindy, the question to you comes from a teacher who wonders why there aren't more educators involved in the process of crafting legislation, of forming groups like this. Do you think the reform community is doing a good enough job reaching out to teachers?
I think we're trying. There's a number of groups here in Indianapolis. If you're interested in this kind of policy work, there's an organization called Teach Plus, where teachers can apply for policy fellowships. They did a lot of work in the legislative session with us. Last year, they did a lot of work on IPS's contract and riffing policies last year. It's a really neat group to get involved with. Stand for Children is an advocacy group that works with families. I know a lot of educators who are involved members and volunteer and take part in these conversations. The one of the things that we did at the Department of Ed, sort of right after Dr. Bennett took office, and we were involved in Race to the Top conversations, going into this legislative session, we knew it was going to be very contentious, and change is hard for folks, so we actually established a new position called Educator Outreach. She's fabulous. She runs a reform cabinet of teachers and educators. And I worked with a team of 9 educators from around the state working on a lot of this evaluation work for the past 2.5 years. And then we did a whole lot of work with a lot of the untested subject areas that Mike talked about. So we gathered arts teachers, special ed teachers to come together to talk about assessments. So there are ways. It's hard to get communications out, and we're working on it every day with the knowledge that we need to sort of, it's very easy to get in a rut with the same avenues with organizations and teachers, so we're trying to expand that as much as we can. But I can say that you are more than welcome, the more the merrier, and the better that process becomes.
Senator, you violated the lightning round rules, by the way.
I did already.
But that's okay.
I did?
No. I was joking with Minnie.
Senator, not surprised.
is it reasonable to expect great strides with legislation that is enacted at the same time that schools are increasingly feeling budget cuts and talking about teacher layoffs?
Pass. Next question. I think it's a both and. We have to both put the right systems in place, and then we have to provide the resources to fund those systems to work well. So I'm advocating for increased funding for K-12 ed in Colorado at the same time I'm advocating for these reforms.
Do you want to close?
Wow, I wasn't ready for that question. I would just say 2 things. One is, if you haven't met Caitlin Hannon yet, you should meet her and vote for her for school board, because she's running right now and is a great educator running for school board. Second is, I would say that the most significant part of what made for success in the development of policy in Colorado and is what made for success in the implementation over the last year has been unprecedented levels of public involvement in the debate. We've had, for the first time, really active teacher groups, and some associations, some just individual teachers, really active principals, really active parents, very active business community. And what happens so often is a big idea gets thrown out, you pass a policy, then everyone who's paying attention goes back to their day job, and the small number of 8 lobbyists who get paid to track that bill every day are the ones that spend the next 2 years actually writing the regulations to kill it or save it. And what saved us, I think, was all of the folks who cared about this issue came to the table and stayed at the table. And they paid attention every time there was a new rule made. They paid attention every time there was a new draft that came out. And so I would just say the best way you make great public policy is by having the prime consumers of this education system, which are parents and businesses and community members, be as actively involved as long as they can.
Well, thank you. I'm going to turn the program back over to Larry. Thank you for the questions, everyone.
If we could have one more round of applause for our wonderful panel here this evening. And along with our tremendous moderator, the lightning round was a bonus. Applause for Matt Tully. And I too wanted to thank, I think she may have left, but our council president, Maggie Lewis, and Representative Marianne Sullivan for being here this evening. Their schedules are jam-packed, as many of ours are, but they get pulled and twisted in a lot of different directions, so I really appreciate you giving up yet another night to be with us this evening, so thank you. And I also wanted to thank Christina, who was also one of our question people. I didn't realize she was going to do that, but thank you, Christina, for being with us this evening and helping out. Last and certainly not least, I want to again thank the library and want to thank our special guest, Senator Mike Johnson, for being with us tonight. Thank you, Senator. And in closing, we do have another event coming up June 13th, and don't yawn, but it's on education finance. And as you heard from a lot of the questions tonight, money is what makes the world go around. So it really is kind of at the heart of a lot of what we're talking about. So please plan on joining us. It'll be June 13th. We'll be joined by Paul Hill. If you don't know who Paul is, I think I'm safe in saying he's probably the foremost expert in education finance in this country. And I know I can probably get an argument in some circles, but if you not Google him, look up some of his work. Just fantastic. He is joining us that night, and I believe we'll start a little earlier, 6:30, but we'll let everybody know. So. Yes, make sure that you gave us your email address, and we'll keep you posted on that. So with that, again, thank you to the library, and thank all of you for being here tonight with the wonderful questions. We'll stick around for a few more minutes if some of you want to come up and ask those questions that didn't get answered. But thank you very much, and please drive safely. Thank you.